Before I call on the first speaker, I'd like to make a few remarks. There was a time, I guess you might call it a happy time, when one could distinguish several different information processing activities which were distinct. The transmission of information from one person to another was called communication, and there were highly repetitive but routine processing of data tasks where the data was represented by holes in punch cards, and this activity was something carried on by business establishments mainly. And then there were engineering and scientific computations. Since those innocent days, there have been a number of complicating developments. The business data processor has tried to expand his machine boundary by means of communication lines for the purposes of acquiring the information by the same in the same system that processes it. This is achieved by connecting communication lines to the sources, to the physically to the locations at which the transactions take place. Companies have tried to link their various facilities together so that there are computers here and there which are connected to a central machine, thus providing machine-machine linkages. And in the first case, we provided man-to-machine linkages. These linkages are mostly made by means of facilities which were designed initially for person-to-person linkages. We've had computers become larger and become capable of serving a number of independent users simultaneously. So communication circuits have been used to link these users to the shared computer. People have discovered that software is more expensive than machines and have discovered that it may be attractive to use a remotely located machine for a particular computation rather than a local machine for software reasons. Once again, the communication system has been married with the simple computing system that we had in the past. And I think perhaps the most wonderful discovery is that something about the nature of computers themselves, which is that they are really not, that computers and communication systems aren't really different kinds of animals. Computers, it seems, are essentially communication mechanisms themselves. Their fundamental role might better be characterized in terms of their information storage and retrieval capability than in terms of their arithmetic capability. We can think of the computing operation itself as perhaps being some kind of an information transformation process for the purpose of facilitating human communication with information. Computers also have been discovered as a means of communication by which a group of people working jointly and cooperatively on some task can communicate in a way that they couldn't communicate with traditional communication systems. All right, what's the problem? The problem seems to be that the communication system that's been built and the computing systems which we have don't always work well together. And when we put the things together, the components together, there are system problems. I think there's a twofold basis for this difficulty. Let me say before citing my twofold things, let me cite a threefold thing. There are technical problems, there are operational problems, and there are regulatory problems. And no discussion of these communication computer thing can be held for more than a few moments without getting into the regulatory and operational problems. I guess officially the panel here is not primarily competent in the regulatory area, and we're going to try to get some technical content into this session, even though we'll keep coming back to regulatory questions, I'm sure. The twofold basis, however, behind all of these problems is that, in the first place, the communication system was designed for man-to-man communication, primarily, not for man-to-machine or machine-to-machine communication. And when I say the system, I'm talking about the operating people, the hardware, the regulations, and so forth. It's quite a stable system, quite highly standardized. There's a huge investment in it. It's not easy to change it, either in the attitudes of the people, or the machinery, or the regulations. Secondly, the state of the computer art is such that while There now exists a rather large man-machine and machine-machine traffic. Little really is known about the nature of this traffic. Little really is known about what the traffic should be for a particular functional service. Nobody knows really much about what message length should be, or holding time should be, or what the requirements are for full duplex versus half duplex service, what the permissible message delays are, what the required transmission bandwidth is, and so forth. We have systems running. These systems are running using the facilities that are available, and we're learning something about these things. I think a quick summary of the state might be something like this. We have this large, highly standardized communication system. We grumble about it as computer users, but it still is the best in the world. We also have the rapidly growing, dynamically changing, heterogeneous set of computer communication requirements. And what I say is a requirement today as a computer user is not what I said last year as a requirement as a computer user. There's much hand-wringing about this. There's a lot of complaining. There are a few computer users, and certainly there are many in the communication side of the industry who are making efforts at various levels to solve this problem, both in terms of modifying the facilities and services that are available and in terms of understanding the problem. Today we're going to hear from some of the people who are trying to solve the problem. One of the bold efforts is under the direction of Dr. Lawrence G. Roberts of the Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Dr. Roberts is formerly of Lincoln Lab and very well known and highly respected in the computer community. Under his direction, a network known as the ARPA network is being constructed, specifically toward the goal of getting understanding of and demonstration of the use of a computing system to solve one of the problems that I've mentioned earlier. Now, I think without further remarks on my part at this time, except for one that I was charged to make, which I'll now make, we'll call on Dr. Roberts to speak. But let me say first that the message desk is absolutely full of messages. Some of them must be for some of you people. The message desk is on the second floor next to the hospitality suite out here, and while I don't think you should go out and inquire during Dr. Roberts' talk, you might do it sometime. Larry? There's a bell ringing thing here. We'll see.
Thank you. In putting together all of the research computing systems which ARPA supports, and looking at all of the work going on, ARPA came to the conclusion that there was a lot of work at other locations from each individual one, which would be very useful to that node, each node. There's a lot of duplication in a large set of research projects because they're at different places in the country. This duplication is necessary, and not precisely duplicative, but in any case, if a person at one node needs a program to do syntactic analysis, for instance, and a person at another node needs it, then, in fact, they have a severe problem if they have different machines and different languages and so on in obtaining that program that exists at the first place. So they build their own. It is perfectly understandable and a necessary expense. The same is true of data. If a large data file exists at one place and other people need to utilize that same type of data, that same data bank, they have to transcribe it or move it somehow. Now, there's a whole set of other problems associated with not having any interactive communication between the computer systems. I'll refer back to some of them as I go through the talk, but basically they lead to the need for a network linking these research centers together so that they can, in fact, utilize each other's systems in the same way that they would use the system via a remote console or by a console if they were there, even a display console if they were there. You want them to be able to use the programs and data on that system via their own system, hopefully without really having to worry about the fact that it's a different system. Now, let me give you a brief example. If I can have the first slide. Now, that's the end. Can you put them in the reverse order? In any case, let's say a person at one location is intending to use, as same example, a syntax analysis program that exists at another location. How would he go about it? Well, okay, hold that slide for a minute and I'll get to it. He would use that syntax analysis program at the other location by writing some program at his location which utilized it. For instance, he was using a program which was working with, say, a conversational information retrieval system, and he wanted to use natural English. He didn't want to write his own syntax analysis of the English, so he would send this English sentence off to the other location, have it parsed, and send back the results to use it for his conversational information retrieval system. Okay, this could be done in many of the cases in the research I'm talking about, and the way it would be done would be to build into his own program a call through the network to send off this sentence to the other location and have sent back the parsed information. That's just one simple example. The data involved, you see, though, is very interactive. He wants the response in a second or less because, in fact, he's working with an interactive system himself. And the data is not very long. It's a short message. That gives you just one example to start with and of the type of thing we want to allow. There are a lot of other examples. And in order to achieve that, we looked at various types of communication. We wound up using a store and forward network between all of the locations. And to bring you right into what that looks like, the first slide shows you the at least one view of the eventual configuration of that network. Now, actually, that isn't very close to what I'm currently intending. Well, it's fairly close if you don't look at the details. There will probably be something like two cross-country lines. That's one feature. The nodes are our research centers, mainly at universities and research organizations throughout the country. These are places like MIT and Lincoln Lab and the RAND Corporation, the University of Illinois, places of this type where we have computer research programs. The network you see is a collection of 50 kilobit leased lines which connect store and forward processors at each of the nodes. You'll see a little bit more of its organization later. But in this picture, you'll note that the traffic goes between the nodes, and there is no direct connection between a particular pair of nodes you might care to send traffic between, and so it has to be store and forwarded from some other location. Now, the general properties of this net are that it can handle an insertion rate of traffic at each node of about 50 kilobits, something in that order, and it can get a message from any node to any other node in about a tenth of a second. The reasons for that we'll get to. Okay, now that's the next slide shows you the topology of that net in more detail. You see, the real distance between the nodes is not critical. It's really the store and forward distance that you have to worry about. The average store and forward distance between nodes in this net is around 2.5, so that if you start at any node and have to send a message to some other node, you may have to go about 2.5 steps on the average. Now, you see, there are alternate routes available for getting a message from any place to any place. That dead-end link there probably won't exist in the final net. But if there is a need for such a thing, it's perfectly feasible within the concept. The alternate routes are used by a routing procedure which determines what the best route at any point in time is, dynamically based on the traffic loading, or by what the best algorithm we find useful. The routing algorithm will be worked out in more detail as the system progresses. Okay, the next slide shows you the basic concept of how these users interact. And I think there's one difference here that ought to be noted. There are many systems which claim to be computer networks and which work in a very simple, very similar overall manner, looking at it from the outside, but are very different conceptually. And that is the fact that the communication is really between user programs and not between the system programs at the locations. This message let me take this through. A person is sitting at the console and is trying to work with, say, the syntax program on the right in that other system. His local user program on the left in his system is the one it requests it. It gets the data back, and the data is massaged by his own program before it goes to his console. If you look at various other systems, you will find in some cases that anything that comes from the net must go directly to the user's console, and if he wants then his program to look at it, it has to be typed back in. This, I feel, is a mistake for the type of operation which we want to be able to maintain. Even if all we wanted to do was use other systems directly as they were intended to be used from a console and not massage it with our own programs as a subroutine. That is, if we're at a location that's far away and we are using, say, the JAWS system at RAND, which is an interactive simple mathematics system, then it takes a special kind of console. Nobody else has that kind of console who doesn't have a JAWS console, and we would want the local user program at each site, if people were trying to use JAWS, to work out the right manipulation of the data and representation to fit the particular console involved and have that flexible, not part of the system. So this helps straighten out the incongruity between various types of terminals. The next slide just shows you the general concept. You have each computer tied to an IMP at its own site. There won't be any of the type C up top. And each IMP may handle one or more local computers called hosts in our vernacular at that site. For instance, at MIT, there are several computers in Project Mac, and each one of those might want to be able to work with the IMP in Project Mac independently, and therefore there may be more than one computer at a node. But the tie between the IMP and the main computer, the host, is a high-speed digital link. And I'll give you briefly its characteristics. It's a something on the order of 250 kilobit serial digital line with bit-by-bit asynchronous control so that words may be shifted into any length word in the other machine. The interface can be different if required, but we're trying to maintain some sort of standard if possible. That is, it could be an 8-bit parallel line if that was desired, but we have such a diversity of machines, we need something which will work in the 6-bit cases, too. Now, it's not just characters going across the net, I should have mentioned, and that's why, in fact, we need to be able to match word lengths for binary information, if that comes about. The next slide shows you essentially how messages move on the network. Now, a message, by definition, in the way we're thinking of it, is something which is given from the main computer, one of the main computers, to the IMP, which is Interface Message Processor, and it's really part of the communication system. As you give this message to it, it won't be in this form. It will be a longer message, perhaps 1,000 characters, with a maximum length of about that, which the IMP will break up into small packets of about 1,000 bits to go on the net. A reason for 1,000 bits is partly due to the speed of the communication lines we've chosen, 50 kilobits. That means about 1/50 of a second. If you have to wait for the previous packet to get out, the longest wait you might have to have for a high priority message. And secondly, based on the error rate, we are using retransmission in the network, and we don't want too long a block in case there are errors. Although measurements on the communication lines, the 50 kilobit lines which we've seen so far, show that 1,000 bits is much shorter than is necessary for a low retransmission rate on these type lines. You could probably go to 10,000 bits without much problem. But from the point of view of interactiveness, then you don't want to go too much longer than this until you go to higher bandwidth lines. Now, I should say there's one other reason, and that is we don't expect our messages to be much longer than this on the average anyway, but in some cases they will be longer. The start of the block is just ASCII-compatible control, and then it keeps track of the destination and origin of the message and the other relevant features. There will be a message ID as generated by the host computer, which essentially says which link this is. And a link should not be confused with the actual communication links. A link is a tie between two users, in effect. There may be many links between two hosts, but I won't need to use that definition too much, so let me leave it at that. The text or binary content of the message is the main body of it. It may consist of one character, and that may be the response to a query saying no or something like that. It may be used, for instance, by people who are using character by character full duplex consoles. Several of our systems, for instance, the 940 systems at Berkeley, like to use their consoles in a full duplex mode, where each character sent by the teletype is looked at by the computer, and the response, either that character then typed or some other character typed if that was viewed to be a control character or an error or something like that. This we think we can maintain on the net. We're not sure of the response. It's very critical. A 1/10 of a second type response just barely fits the criteria for this kind of operation. Longer delay than that is intolerable for that type of operation. But there's no real requirement that that go on the network if it's not easily handled. Usually, you would expect people to accumulate a line of text if they were working in a console rather than character by character. Then the text may be longer. If it is text, it will most likely be sent in ASCII form and retranslated and translated at each node into the character set for that computer, or translated out of that computer's character format into ASCII. There's some controversy over this, however, because people feel that no standard can incorporate all of the variations that everybody wants, and that so much translation needs to go on semantically beyond the simple syntactic translation that doing the transformation to ASCII is a waste of time. We hope to resolve that controversy soon. In any case, then there's a parity check at the end, which is a cyclic 24-bit parity check. And this was chosen based on the fact that for this length message and these type of lines, we shouldn't have more than one undetected error in the network per year. This may not be required in some networks, but for an experimental network where we got enough other problems to face, wasting a few bits to guarantee we don't have errors every day is very useful. And we can look for where the errors really are. You can't go much lower than 16 on this type of thing without running into real problems. Now that just, when this message is sent from one location to another, the routing algorithm would look at the destination at an intermediate imp and say, okay, the destination is node 10, and it looks in a table and says, for node 10, the optimal route at this time is to go out link number 4 of the links that it has available to it. Each node has perhaps 3 to 5 communication links, 50 kilobit lines, and it would send out the message on that link, put it in the queue for that link. Let me go on to the next slide. And well, the next slide. Oh, okay. Yeah, there was no more. Fine. Now let me tell you something about the IMP itself. Current and the schedule. Currently, we have contracted with Bolt, Brannick, and Newman in Cambridge to build and install the IMPs. They have subcontracted with Honeywell to utilize 516 computers with special data channels built for doing the cyclic parity check and handling the 50 kilobit lines. The cost of these IMPs will be around 80 or 90 K a piece. The throughput of one of these IMPs, it can handle about 7 lines where the capacity is not defined for each line, but in total shouldn't exceed 500 kilobits each way, or about a total of a million bits per second passing through the central processor. The reason for that is because in handling the average length message, which is viewed to be somewhere under 300 bits in length, the headers take the time in the computer, and you don't have the processing time to handle more headers per second than that indicates. If the messages were longer, we could handle considerably more traffic. It could get up to 4 million bits per second if the messages were full length. Now, this is perhaps to be viewed in comparison with some of the older technology store and forward systems, and I think I'd like to claim that this is not to be put in the same category, even in some sense. There were several decisions made which make the store and forward systems philosophy somewhat different than, say, AutoDIN in the DoD network or various other systems you may be familiar with. And this philosophy mainly was that the network is not a storage place for messages. It's a transmission system. And we don't want people storing all of their information within the net. These time-sharing systems at the various endpoints of the net are capable of absorbing the information. They're capable of holding it back if nobody wants it at the other end. And that's the way computer systems now and in the future most likely will react. Therefore, we don't need the system to hold the message until the receiver can take it. Okay, so there is a fundamental difference, and due to this difference, the switch comes out to be very much simpler. There is no drum, no disk, no I.O. storage. It's all core transfer. The queuing and the holding of messages and so on for retransmission has been simulated and worked out and appears to be no problem for the type of holding times we expect in terms of the final nodes. Looking at the cost, then, let me just briefly compare it with something like AutoDIN, or then again with something like a leased line or dial-up system. The communication lines for this net, if you put in the 19 nodes or any number of nodes actually above 10 or so, turns out to run around 47K per year per node in that vicinity. That's based on the TELPAC tariffs and the actual, and I should point out the TELPAC tariffs are somewhat lower to DoD since we share them in bulk, but there's not a huge discrepancy here. The IMPs themselves, if you amortize them, would be something like 25K a year. And various other things like maintenance and so on bring the total to perhaps 85K a year that we're paying for each node. For this, we have about 68 kilobits of traffic each way from each node. And this is extendable. If nobody else is using the net, you might well go up to 200 kilobits yourself. So it's very flexible. If you're not using the node, then other people can use you for a transfer point much more fully. This comes down to then a cost. If you figure the average use we're going to make of the net and the time of day we'll use it and all of that, comes down to about 22 cents per megabit that we can transfer data for. The cost within AutoDIN, which is the DoD star and forward system, which is designed differently and has a response delay of not a tenth of a second, but 2 to 20 seconds for messages, comes to something between $2 and $40 per megabit. I don't want to quote a precise figure because I can't get them to give me one, but it's in that range. It looks to me to be, for their average use, around 40. Now, the result of this is that there's, of course, a huge discrepancy here, and why is it? And the discrepancy is totally in terms of the switch cost. Two things. The switch cost is very important. The switch cost, in their case, is 98.2% of the total cost of the system. Switches are very expensive. And as I said, that's because of the drums and disks and the transfer through the computer and everything else. Uses up more computer time per message if you have to do that and so on. Secondly, and of course, we're working with later generation equipment. Secondly, the leased trunks are very much lower capacity bandwidth, and so we gain a factor of 2 to 4 on the cost of transmission links because of the using 50 kilobit links. But that isn't the major factor. Now, as compared to dial-up, we just can't achieve the same response. We can't dial up for 30 seconds or something. Maybe that can be reduced to 4 seconds or even less, but I didn't debate the need for a store and forward system to begin with as compared to a dial-up system. I hope you see that, in fact, this kind of response is just not obtainable with any sort of dial-up system. I have instantaneous capability to send a message to any other computer in the net, and this just I can't obtain any other way. Even if I did try and obtain it and reduced my requirements considerably, the cost, it turns out, is also a couple orders of magnitude higher, at least one. So that I find that the transmission is now not costing me very much at all. Compared to my computing, it's maybe 10%. And I have very good capacity for at least the next few years. I really expect that this type of system, though, can be increased to work with the tea carriers directly and in a much larger system. And what I would just point out in conclusion is that it can be, if a lot of people were using a network, a complete system for a large set of data users, and I encourage AT&T or someone as a carrier to build it for us rather than having to have us build it after this point in time. But I'll leave that for them. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Roberts. That's at least one person who's trying to do something about it. Gentlemen, there are a few spare seats and with coats and things on them, and there are a number of people standing. Will you do the best you can to make room for those who are standing? There's some seats over here, gentlemen, in the back. The speaker is Dr. Gerald Estrin, a professor of electrical engineering, UCLA. He'll talk to us about the requirements for on the communication system for online interactive computing. Jerry?
I'll set your clock, too. Verify the mic.
No, let's talk into that mic, okay.
I'll declare myself as a professor of computer sciences who is a renegade from electrical engineering. Let me introduce my topic by saying that I'm going to concentrate some attention on the university. There was a time long back in the dim past when one might have looked on the university as an ivory tower. These days, we don't tend to think of university campuses that way. They're probably the liveliest spots in the country. But there is also a few important characteristics about the campus that just want to be set in their place as background. First of all, among these characteristics, campuses are big businesses. We don't just talk about a research environment. There's a large commercial effort going on in the administration of these organizations. Aside from this big business and management aspect, you have the gamut of activities in teaching and attempting to train people to meet the impossible needs of the future, and of a rather high level of research activity running all the way from somebody sitting at a terminal or working with pencil and paper or wanting to connect all possible types of laboratory apparatus to a computer system for analysis. So that, and it is also true that on the campuses, this same live wire attitude that's making the campuses hop so, is also found in the students who are active in computer sciences. They may not be so active in some of the demonstrations that take place, but you look into the eyes of these guys and you see that they're the ones who can really introduce innovation in our own technical field in a way that cannot be done in many other industrial enterprises where people do have to keep their attention on a product that has to be turned out and has to meet deadlines now. And as you talk to these people, you know that you want to harness all of that innovative energy in the strongest way possible. Now, and it's no accident then that Larry Roberts takes on so courageous a task as to seek the implementation of a network that he described before, which essentially links up research laboratories and a large number of university centers. And it's one of the crazy characteristics of that, which makes it a fine experimental environment, that there are almost no two systems the same on that network. It's totally inhomogeneous. And if that thing is going to work, people are going to have to learn to use systems that are entirely different from the ones they're used to at home. With respect to that, it's just a little less than a year ago. In one of my graduate courses, that there were some 24 students, pretty far advanced in their work, and they tossed out the task to them as part of a project. They said, you have machine A, and you have programs running on machine A, and you want them to run on machine B. Now, your task is first by simulation, by writing programs. You want your programs that ran on machine A to run on machine B, and then you can go on and do some hardware design to try and make that a reasonably efficient process. Let's see how well you do. Now, it also happened that in the early part of the quarter, there was a short presentation telling them about the possibly forthcoming ARPA network. Well, there was one unanimous conclusion in this full set of reports that came in from these students. And they said, we throw up our hands, bring us the network. Because after going through this process of making any machine A act like machine B and actually execute the same programs, they found that they were introducing such high factors of attenuation that it would be cheaper for them to buy or lease that machine A rather than trying to run the programs on a simulated machine. A 6600 was running something like a 360 Model 40 by the time they got through even with their hardware innovations. And so they said, bring on that network. Yes, we would like, it makes much more sense for us to get our programs running on the machine where the programs themselves were written. Now, that's all well and good that came out like motherhood, but I want to make some remarks about the really fundamental difficulties in learning to use a network of the type that Larry Roberts described. Now, the things that characterize requirements of the computer users on the campus, yes, in most cases you have to insist on some fraction of a second of response time. With some messages, though, yes, you can stand seconds, and with others, depending on the amount of computation that's taking place, you can go into minutes, hours, and days. I mean, there are some computations that just stretch over very lengthy periods, and then people have a great deal of patience. If you're sitting at a terminal and have no other communication with a computer system, well, you come back to the fraction of a second because you must be informed about what is going on. Now, there are some rather serious problems of human engineering. I've always been impressed at one commercial show that I went to where there was a small computer system, and there was a gal sitting at that small computer system, and what she would do, it was a form-oriented system, she would type in a few words, wait, and the computer would go clickety-clack for a while, and then would come back with a response. And that gal was sitting and waiting most of her time. She didn't even have time to read a good novel or a detective story or a love story. I mean, it was just a sort of impossible situation where she was like being stimulated once every 2 minutes, to insert a couple of pieces of information into the machine, but she had to be there. There was no question about it. On the campus itself, one has to think not in terms of the teletype terminals that we operate with now, but much more in terms of graphics terminals, the cathode ray tube terminals, which people will be demanding for interactive purposes. And these things have a very different character. For one thing, that instead of
trying to solve the response, and all the programmers did this using it on cutting edge. And every time they try a different
You go one way, you don't get in, you don't get enough precision. If you go the other way, too small, and then you get too much round.
I knew nothing. Minimum amount about numerical methods.
Well, that's another ability. So the problem is to get deep into a numerical method, you don't have any experience at all. Most of these guys are managers, they're getting soft, and at least they're lucky if they're usually not differentiating the square.
Well, like the problem I ran into here, I was going to do this problem, and what that computer now is learning.
Have to in fact be amplified, and there has to be a second pass through the design process just in order to get this load handling capability within internal machine organization itself. Now, it was some of these difficulties, some of the problems that arose in the design of computers that led people like Hugh Crane at Stanford Research Institute to dream in terms of something he called an heuristor. Because in computer design, it turned out he was rather jealous of our nervous system, which had the type of transmission links which did not need any special kind of handling. They had the capability of sending a regenerated signal along the neural paths, and he sought to implement something like that for communication between computer components. Why I raise this point is that the computer system designer, or the computer communications system designer, inherently would like this building block to work with in developing any large system. He would like to separate the problem of transmission from the set of complex functions that he is designing into his network. And the communication system that was displayed as part of the ARPA network itself is, you know, something, a system for handling the communication that has some of these properties. Now, on a scale as large as the ARPA network, this brings us some solutions to our problems. However, if one looks down at any of the research centers themselves, and Larry Roberts pointed this out, they're there as a point, as a node, but in fact, they tend to be a complete ensemble of machines of different types, connected to laboratories, connected to users, and in many cases, there is the desire to interconnect these machines among themselves. In other words, some of the same problems that are being dealt with nationwide will exist in any one of these nodes, these research centers, or these campuses, or an industrial center. Now, there we have attempted to face these problems a number of times and find that the basic technology is just not present. In design of computer systems, we've now gotten spoiled to a certain sense. There really has been a very extensive development of basic modules so that a man can sit down and design almost anything that he wants. In fact, the deepest problem that he has is one of decision, you know, which set of modules to put together. Right now, there are no good guidelines for making those decisions, and it's an art entirely. However, what he finds as he comes out to the periphery of his system and now is considering its interaction with a set of users or a set of laboratories, those outside his nice closed environment, then the things that are available to him off the shelf are not present. He meets all the ambiguity of the regulatory problems, pardon the expression, which are exercising a very subtle inhibition on the development of technology, on the production of tinker toy building blocks, which will allow the development of much more complex systems. Now, there are, in fact, sure, we start off with the recognition, and anybody who visits and looks at technology in any other country of the world, very quickly comes the recognition of the statement, yes, we have the best communication system in the world. There is no question about that. And what you find is that if you are willing to make use of the data rates and the allowable set of connections provided on our present communication system, there are certain things that you can build. As soon as you step outside that, you then talk about years of not just technical development, but years of agreement on what is allowable in these systems. And in fact, I'm just going to really end my comments here by the two simple slides to express this statement. Can I have the first slide? That as we look forward to development of advanced computer utilities, we recognize most strongly that there are a tremendous number of resources which we are unable to tap now because we are limited in our ability to communicate between computer systems. There are many programs which are being done over and over again in different places which would be completely usable by people at any one installation. And what we find, in addition to that, is that because of the high impedance of communication between one center and another, between one user and another, it in fact forces the greater expenditure in computer capacity in the local environment. A much greater expenditure than would be necessary if, in fact, the linkage to other centers were possible. Now, in the design of computer systems themselves, we can put together almost anything that you demand from off-the-shelf modules. Next slide, please. That's an interesting one. Yeah. The fact is that when we come to expanding a computer system to use beyond a small locality of the actual design system, that we find that there are two things. One, the number of off-the-shelf items is terribly small unless one is supporting a teletype type data rate or a telephone coupler. And that secondly, that any prospects of achieving a clear resolution that would remove the inhibitions on new technological development are very poor. Now, what the answers are to this, I do not know. I do know that this particular set of problems is holding back our technology very, very strongly. Now, I want to end up with one last comment about things like the ARPA network, or that set of problems which are opened up when the technological ones are wiped away. Let me assume that we have our communication links between computers. Let me assume that the ARPA network and that communication system is established. Let me assume that even locally, that the equipment is available to link machines together. Then the burden is forced back upon those problems which have not been mentioned very strongly, and they're of two types. One of them, I said that the off-the-shelf modules are available, and that's true for hardware. There are still a very large number of problems that have to be solved in the development of software systems in a similar fashion. And when this burden is removed of the of communication between systems, that burden will now shift back to the computer system developers to properly handle the flood of messages and user programs that want to be operated upon. The second thing is that the deeper problem is really that when you are using a system as complex as a computer that is remote from you, let me say sufficiently remote such that you cannot walk down the hall or down the block or across the city to go into that computer center at times and talk to the people who wrote the original programs and who run the system and know its own intricacies, that the level, the problems established, in, the problems which exist in running a program that somebody else wrote, operating in a system for, with which you have not lived, are non-trivial. And these are ones which we can only begin to investigate when the ARPA network comes into existence. It is my firm belief that we won't get the full utilization of a network like that until something like the picture phone is also tied into the system to produce the more intimate level of allied human communication along with the types of messages that are sent on the network itself. Thank you.